Canadian-born Nielsen began his acting career as the quintessential straight man, but became best known for his deadpan slapstick in movies like Airplane and The Naked Gun.
What was it we had for dinner tonight?
Well, we had a choice, steak or fish.
Yes, I remember I had lasagna.
Nielsen appeared in more than 100 movies, playing the dramatic lead in classics like Forbidden Planet and The Poseidon Adventure. He died of complications from pneumonia at a hospital near his home in Fort Lauderdale. For NPR News, I'm Phil Latzman in Miami.
This is Cyber Monday, with many retailers offering free shipping and other discounts. The National Retail Federation estimates about 70 million Americans will make purchases online today, many of them from work. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from CouponCabin.com, offering coupon codes from online stores and printable coupons for brick-and-mortar stores. More at CouponCabin.com.
Hi, I'm Jim Meadows.
I'm Tom Rogers.
I'm Sean Powers.
And I'm Celeste Quinn. You listen to us on WILL Radio and TV, and now we want to listen to you. Every month, we're out in the community having conversations about your hopes and challenges. What we hear impacts the programs we produce. If you'd like to have a community conversation in your town, give us a call at 217-333-7300 or email willconnect@illinois.edu.
Support comes from the Corkscrew Wine Emporium, 203 North Vine, Urbana, with wines, beers, and spirits for the serious collector to the first-time buyer. Wine tastings are held in Bouvon Tasting Room on Saturdays from noon to 4. More information is available at thecorkscrew.com or at 337-7704.
Good morning and welcome to Focus, our morning talk program. I'm David Inge. Today's first hour comes from the Focus Archives, so as you listen, keep in mind that we will not be taking calls. There are millions of adults who spend hours every week playing video games, although it may not be the kind of thing that you would readily admit to if you are among them. Our guest for this hour of the show, Tom Bissell, who is a dedicated gamer and also professor of English, says, well, maybe until recently he might have been also a little reluctant to admit his love for video games. But in a new book that we'll be talking about this morning, he goes public in defense of an art form that he says he finds both enormously satisfying and also sometimes enormously frustrating, something that's well worth thinking about and taking seriously. The book is titled Extra Lives, Why Video Games Matter. It's published by Pantheon, and it's out just recently. Our guest teaches fiction writing at Portland State University, makes his home in Portland, Oregon, is the author of three other books, Chasing the Sea, God Lives in St. Petersburg, a collection of stories, and The Father of All Things. As we talk, of course, questions, comments are welcome. If there are people out there who play games and are interested in comparing experiences or telling us about why it is that they find them so compelling, you can certainly do that. And Tom Bissell, hello.
Hi, David. Thank you for having me.
Well, thanks very much for joining us. We certainly appreciate it. I have to say right off, my video game experience began and ended with Pong. So I'm... I am not...
You've missed an awful lot.
And there are times when I actually do think that I have, and although it wasn't until reading some of your descriptions of play, of some of the more recent games, that I really started to think that maybe I have missed something. So maybe when I retire, I can take it up as a hobby.
It would be, you know, there are much worse ways to spend a retirement, I think, than playing video games. In fact, Wii's are in tons of retirement homes all over the country, and I've read that they've actually increased the satisfaction and quality of life of a lot of senior citizens.
And just to be clear, I guess, here, what we're talking about here, that because there are some games that people play on PCs where they're using their keyboard and presumably their mouse, I guess. But what we're talking about, the kind of games you're talking about, are console games. They're things that are played on things like the PlayStation and the things that have come before, where you have some kind of thing that you hold in your hands that has buttons and triggers and things, and that's the way you use to enter. That's what you use to interact with the game.
Yes, sir.
And what exactly?
For better or for worse. I'm a console gamer, yeah.
And what, for somebody who's really not initiated into that, what exactly does that mean is the difference between the two kinds of games?
Well, for a long time, PC games, personal computer games, were a lot more elaborate, a lot more sophisticated, a lot bigger. They had a lot more, graphical firepower. and they just had a lot more that they could do. And the consoles came along, and as the consoles became ever more powerful, the console market sort of overwhelmed the PC market. And PC gamers are a very persnickety bunch, and they kind of, I think they're like poets, whereas console gamers are more like prose writers, you know? That'd be the best way I could put it. I mean, a serious PC gamer is someone who can fix his own computer. And you know, one of the many funny things about my interest in games is I am not really interested in technology at all. I'm more interested in games for their storytelling qualities.
Well, and that would invite the question, and the book is not, it's not really, although you do spend time with people who make games, it's not really about that industry. But having said that, though, you wonder, well, people who are involved in this business, are they people who are attracted to it because they are computer geeks, because they're in, you know, they dream in code, or are they people who maybe in another life would have made movies?
I think earlier, you know, for the first 30 years of game development, it was mostly people who, as I put it in the book, sort of came of age in the low-ceilinged monasteries of computer programming. Mm. And these were people that made games for themselves. They didn't care about an audience. They were just, you know, with sort of cross-eyed concentration, they were making games for a very small group of people. And as games sort of entered the mainstream, became more widely spread out throughout, you know, our culture, and more and different kinds of people were playing them, different kinds of people got interested in going into the industry. Now, that said, it's still one of the problems of video games is that it is still primarily a medium of engineers and, you know, computer people, which isn't to say that engineers and computer people haven't given us many fine and wonderful things, but I've noticed talking to a lot of game designers that they sometimes discuss, you know, the storytelling or aesthetic qualities of games, you know, in terms of the latest Hollywood movie they've seen. And it's kind of a problem with games, and it's the one thing that I find most frustrating. But I think in 10 years that situation will be completely different, and you won't even really have to know that much about the technological side of game design to actually have a place, a viable place in the industry. Mm.
Well, that's the argument that you're making here is that these kind of games are a legitimate storytelling medium, and it's a case where those qualities that you can see in games, particularly those there, you can see that more and more in games that have been developed, say, within about the last 5 years, and also you say you think that that's something that would be improved, it would be better and better and better as time goes along. So that, you know, you wonder, well, do they hire people that are, do they hire writers? I mean, are there people whose job it is just to do that?
There's a few of those, but it's still like a writer for a video game company is still like a strange thing to be. The average game is sort of create, you know, because it's all about systems. Games are about systems with which the player interacts. And these systems are massively complicated, and I've seen game design documents that are 20 pages long just describing, you know, how, like, if there's an animal in the game, it's behavior patterns, you know? You have to, like, there's so much massively complicated design questions going to games that things like writing dialogue and storytelling, you know, understandably just seem like one tiny part of this massively complicated thing. And so historically games sort of got developed, the systems were created, and then they dragged in some poor writer and said, hey, create a story to go with all this stuff that we made up. So it's not surprising that a lot of times these stories just seem completely preposterous because, you know, they were games that were created to provide interesting things for players to do moving from one set piece experience to the other. So trying to string those together with a cohesive story is, you know, not an easy thing. And so one of the guys I talked to in the book, Peter Molyneux, who's an English game designer, who's just one of the true geniuses of game design, he describes it as, you know, when you have a film, you spend a very small time building the sets, and then you spend a lot of time filming. But with a game, it's the exact opposite. You spend all your time essentially making the sets, and then a very tiny amount of time, you know, quote-unquote, filming it. And that it does create, like, some real formal problems that don't really seem to have a good answer.
Just to talk a little bit about, even though I said it's not really about the industry, about the industry, I guess I was struck by a couple of things. One is that even as much as we think about video games as being something for children, and you say that's really part of the problem with the way that we think about it, that in fact, on average, the people who are playing the kind of games we're talking about are not children.
Yeah, there are people in their 30s. They're, you know, my age. It's like, I think the average console gamer these days is like 31, 32, and I'm 36. So, that's really the one kind of canard that needs to die, I think, because people often assume that because it's a game, it's meant for children. And if it's a violent game, people are automatically scandalized by its violent content. But the fact is, the people who are making the games are not intending them to be, you know, played by children any more than Martin Scorsese intended, you know, little kids to go see Goodfellas. Which isn't to say the quality of games is as good as Goodfellas, but the emotional experience is trying to give you, a lot of violent games are trying to give you, is equally dark and equally ill-suited to a child.
And the other thing, I suppose, that people often think about video games is that they're things that are created by and for boys.
Well, that is actually a very real problem. And, you know, one of my biggest complaints about the modern video game is, you know, the dearth of interesting parts for women to play as something other than, you know, a love interest or eye candy or some hugely endowed Valkyrie to walk across the screen. But there are some exceptions to this. You know, I think game designers are more and more conscious that, you know, they've basically spent the last 25 years alienating half of the population from, you know, pursuing this medium with any real interest. And so there are a lot more women getting involved in the industry and a lot more women who are writing about games in really interesting ways.
And I think also that I read or maybe heard you say that 40% of the people who play games are women. Is that right?
Yeah, that's true. And I think if you factored in games like social games like Farmville or Chicken Town or whatever the games on Facebook, you know, are, if you factor in those games, then the average age and gender of a gamer turns into a 45-year-old woman. So, you know, our idea of what a game is, what a video game is in particular, a computer game, is pretty elastic. And I kind of resist even speaking in terms of, like, the video game now because it's no more adequate for really describing the nature of something than calling something a novel or a film is. I mean, there's so many possible variations on what, you know, what you can fit into those words conceptually. That it's that's something I find exciting, actually.
I think that I'm sure that, again, the problem or the conception that people come to this whole conversation with is that when you start drawing comparisons, when you start talking about video games as a storytelling medium, and you start to draw some sort of comparisons between novels and movies and video games, they'll say, well, now, wait a minute. Now, it isn't really the reason people play them. They play them for a particular kind of experience that is very visceral, but perhaps also can be somewhat cerebral. But what they really come for is that experience. They don't come really so much for story. They don't come from character development. They come to blow stuff up. And I'm sure that people say, now really, is there anything more to it than that? And are people who play the games looking for anything more than that?
Well, that's a this may require a somewhat complicated answer. The first part of the question is, video game storytelling is unlike novel and film storytelling. And games have gotten really lost in the last few years trying to copy the techniques of film, you know, trying to be, you know, as like a fantasy game that's trying to be as dense and rich and as a populated a world as something in Tolkien. None of that stuff works for games. Game storytelling is very weird, still pretty much foreign territory, I think, to really do game storytelling very well. And so I never would equate the kind of storytelling that a novel can do to a game. I mean, a novel is about interiority. It's about stillness to me. And if I want that kind of experience, I'm glad novels exist. But game storytelling can work in a way that, to me, while not comparable to novels or films, can sometimes be equally amazing and equally wonderful and equally familiar seeming. And what I love about storytelling games is when they create a situation with characters that you come to care about in some way and suddenly force you to the line of some decision that you have to make that you know you're going to have to live with the fictional consequences of your decision within that world. And now that's something that films and books just can't really give you, you know? And games that do that really well become, to me, like, just a hugely compelling, you know, piece of entertainment or art or whatever, you know, you would like to call it. And so the other part of the question is, don't most gamers just want to come and blow stuff up? Mm-hmm. And I think to some degree that's truer than I would like it to be. But at the same time, you know, if the average age of a gamer is 31, the average age of a game designer is something like 40, we're all kind of getting older. And I know I'm getting increasingly sick of, you know, games that are violent for no ostensible aesthetic purpose, that are just violent because they can be. And so I think this medium is kind of growing up at roughly the same pace, you know, people of my generation are, and we're all beginning to have questions of, like, you know, what is aesthetic value and what is morality and mortality? And I think it's no coincidence that, like, some very somber, dark, more darkly themed games have been coming out in the last few years, because that's exactly, I think, the place where the people who are creating these things are coming to naturally, just, you know, through some organic process of getting older. There really wasn't a developed game industry before the people who are, you know, at the top of the heap right now. There was no generation before them doing this.
Hmm. I tell you what, we have a caller here, and let's get to them, and maybe I should very quickly introduce again the guest, Tom Bissell. He teaches fiction writing at Portland State University. He makes his home in Portland, and he's the author of the book Extra Lives, Why Video Games Matter. It's published by Pantheon and is out now. Questions, comments, welcome, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455, and you may email your questions to will-talk@illinois.edu. And we have a caller to bring into the conversation in Champaign. This is line one. Hello.
Hi, great topic. My history is that I remember the first video arcade games in 1975 as far as commercial platforms. However, I think that storytelling is part of video games, but maybe not so much for the U.S. market. If people who are my age remember the original Zelda for the NES, they know that it was more of a string-style game where to get the golden key, you had to get the shoelaces for the guy who had the shoes, but, you know, you spent a lot of time meeting all these characters. And I think Japanese games are more into the backstory and things like that. And what I've noticed is the progression. We had Final Fantasy VII, we had Final Fantasy X, both very appealing story games for younger women. And now the problem is just the complexity of the plot when you're mapping out a string design for people to follow. Because we have Oblivion, we have Assassin's Creed, which are both very violent games, unfortunately. But they do involve storytelling, and I think it's becoming stronger. And unfortunately, as your guest has pointed out, there is this extreme limitation in what the people who market games think people want. Because my son, who enjoys shooters, he also enjoys Gears of War because of the characters. It's because of the character involvement. And he really liked Fallout 3 and Bioshock, both of which have a major storyline for video games. So hopefully it's getting better. But those were just my comments. Thanks.
All right. Well, you want to – Bioshock actually is, I think, is one of the things that you write about in Extra Lives.
Yeah, I think Bioshock, I sometimes think, might be, you know, one of the sort of most – sophisticated and interesting, intellectually speaking, games I've played. And so you can say that, and then on the other hand, you can say that it's a game about shooting lightning out of your hands at people, you know, so yet again, you're at this weird thing with games where you try to explain to someone why this game is so affecting and interesting, because it's a kind of about Ayn Rand's objectivism, believe it or not. it's sort of an exploration of, you know, what would happen if someone founded a society based on Ayn Rand's philosophy. And the answer is very little good. And so the game sort of marches you through a collapsed objectivist utopia. So it's totally, you know, heady. It's really interesting. And yet it's also got this... this, you know, game design prerequisite of, you know, marching you through one room after another in which you just, you know, shoot everyone. But I don't regard that as a problem, but when I hear it, when I describe it that way, I really can understand why people who are temperamentally moved to object to games. I can kind of see where they're coming from sometimes.
Well, I also wonder, say in a case like this, so you have a game that where you would say, well, part of what's going on here is an exploration of Ayn Rand's objectivist philosophy, and I wonder how many people playing this game know who Ayn Rand is, would have any interest in that, would get the fact that that is what it is, and for them that would be another dimension of playing the game and something that they would enjoy and that they'd say we'd get out of it that as opposed to just the thing where you're going around shooting lightning out of your hands.
Well, I think you might be surprised. There's a hugely vigorous online community of people writing about games, and you know, I've seen stories about BioShock's philosophical conundrums pile up, you know, sometimes hundreds, sometimes 500-600 comments on blogs. So, you know, maybe not everyone's getting the subtext, but, you know, I think enough people are that the success of that game really led a lot of people to see, wow, you can actually do things that are sort of thematically daring in games, you know, as long as you sort of provide enough interesting traditional shoot 'em up stuff, you can actually get people to explore some pretty out there conceptual frameworks for a game.
Right. Let's talk with someone else. This is someone in Cerro Gordo, line two. Hello.
Hi there, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. I'm not familiar, or I usually don't play any games, but my nine-year-old son really enjoys them, and in particular, he enjoys Lego games. And I know they seem to follow formats of popular movies, and I wondered if you could explain why that particular format, the Lego games, is so popular with people his age, and maybe other age groups as well.
Yeah, I would love to speak to that. I really love those Lego games. I think they're really fun. In fact, I think the Lego games based on the first, you know, Star Wars prequels, I enjoy them a hell of a lot more than the movies that they're based on. I've thought a lot about why the Lego Star Wars combination is so hugely satisfying. All I can think is that it just takes two things that children just naturally gravitate toward, you know, little plastic blocks that you can build stuff with, and the thing you most wanted to build but never could when you were a kid, which was Star Wars stuff. And you know, I'm not embarrassed to say that I played almost every Lego game that's come out, and they're really inventive, they're really fun, they've got a wonderful sense of humor. And the puzzles, there's like spatial puzzles in the game that are actually pretty interestingly done and fun to work out. And I play the games with my nieces a lot, and the Lego games, and I can just tell you it's just, you know, a mainlined happiness when the three of us are playing them together. It's really fun.
Well, thank you.
All right, thank you. Other calls, comments, questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. You talked a little bit earlier about one of the appeals of the games that we're talking about, and one thing that's maybe different. It's different from how it is that people participate in watching a movie or reading a book, is that there's this active component. That is, you do things, and depending on what you do, then other things happen. So that you take actions, but those actions have consequences within the world of the game. And there are maybe some things where there are no going back. Having said that, you know, I also wonder, well, you know, there are games here and you kill people, you die. Well, all you need to do is reset and you're back at the start. Now, you do have to go back at the start, which may be a problem. But does that undercut the the consequence, sort of consequence of actions issue, if all you have to do is push a button and then you start again.
Now, this is like a huge fault line right now in game design, between like really thoughtful game designers talk about this very issue all the time. It's, you know, the irrevocability of choice issue.
Uh-huh.
How irrevocable do you really want to make choices for gamers? On the one hand, it increases, you know, the consequence of the thing that has happened. But on the other hand, the potential to alienate and frustrate people that you want to sit there and play your game through and experience it, the alienation factor goes up hugely. I'm not sure there's a really good answer to this. I can tell you that when I'm playing a game I really love, I want to respect the decisions the designers have made. And so if they make it very hard for me to go back and undo things I've done, I try not to go unback and undo those things. I try to live with the decisions I've made. And that sounds really pretentious and strange when you're talking about, you know, what are essentially just pixels moving around and photons moving around in your screen. But, I mean, I think it's no different than, a horror movie. When you look away, when you see the killer stalking the heroine, a really good work of popular art or entertainment convinces you to believe in it. And I love to be convinced to believe in things. I love that feeling in books, I love it in movies, and I love it in games. So I kind of wish more game designers would have the, huevos to really just really slam down the mallet of consequence and make everything you do irrevocable. But I also realize that commercially speaking, that would be an extremely hard thing to release onto the market, given most gamers' predilections.
And I guess there also is some difference between games that, I suppose it depends what it is. It's a difference in the commitment that you have to make, and that people, I think, are probably familiar with the idea that games, they have different levels and they have different goals, and that over time what you're essentially is you're working your way steadily from one place to another. And that maybe there are some games where it's easier to stop where you are and then at some time later come back and just essentially start again where, you know, save where you are, just freeze things there, and then come back later. And that there are other games where it's a much more difficult business, and I'm sure it's much harder to say, well, okay, I'm done with this for right now, and maybe next week I'll go back and do it again.
Again, this speaks to like the huge variety of games. There are open world games that give you a giant world to explore on your own time. You can save wherever you want. You can stop when you're bored. There are like more sort of pulse pounding games that make every decision that you're making in real time count, because the places you can save are few and far between. And this is another really interesting theoretical discussion that gets right to the bottom of the type of experience certain game is wanting to give you. Japanese games, for whatever reason, have historically been much, much harder and much, much more brutal and much, much more punishing when it comes to things like saving your progress, finding a safe place. For whatever reason, the Japanese just love their games to be an entire magnitude more difficult than we like our games here.
I have an email here from someone who's listening to the conversation, and it sounds like they're interested in they don't have experience with these kinds of games, but they're interested in kind of giving it a try. And in fact, we have here this is one member of a married couple who's looking maybe for the possibility, and I'm not sure if he's thinking about games that he and his wife would play together, or maybe just games that she also would like. He said she likes slot machines, so she thinks that she might enjoy gaming at home on their HD TV. He says his wife is fairly traditional in her interests, and so is he. So that means that they have maybe things that we might think of as stereotypically gender-based interests. So one of the questions he asked is, has anyone managed to devise a game that really could capture both men and women?
Yeah, there's a few. Not as many, again, as we would all like. But there's a game that came out recently called Heavy Rain, which is... it's kind of like a murder mystery, basically, that you control four different characters, three men and one woman. It doesn't require like super fast reflexes. You just sort of wander around, talk to people, and do very simple actions with these really kind of ingeniously devised prompts that you have to, like, move the controller a certain way. It's much more intuitive. It's not pushing buttons so much as it's manipulating the controller in really weird and interesting ways. Like, if your character will walk up to a doorknob, and it will have you, like, turn your joystick in roughly the way that you would turn the doorknob. And so this is an interesting game because the very first scene in the game is a father who loses his child in a crowd. And you have to walk through this crowd looking for your kid. And, you know, for a video game to seek to exploit that source of human experience for anxiety rather than, like, you know, being chased by a giant kangaroo spitting acid at you, you know, was really hugely great for me. I mean, I just loved seeing, like, a father searching for his son in a crowd being used as this, like, really riveting and really frightening video game experience. And my girlfriend and I played Heavy Rain, and she really loves it, and she had a complete revelatory experience with it. It's a really terrific game for a couple to try together, I think. Another game might be a game called Portal, which I think is probably as close to, like, a perfect game, I think, that there might be out there. It's basically, you wake up in a laboratory and there's a computer voice talking to you, and it seems to want to help you, but as you go through the game, you realize that it's actually trying to kill you. So it's just you and this voice navigating through these test laboratory rooms and puzzles. And it very gradually just becomes this hugely scary, frightening, ominous experience that really I can't find an analog to in any other kind of entertainment. Because the cool thing about Portal is that everyone realizes the computer's out to get them at a different time. You know, if it were a movie, there'd be the unmasking moment. But in the game, you just kind of work it out. Well, now everyone's going to work it out because I've told them the secret. But it's not that big of a secret. But the point is that the interactivity of the medium actually presents each player with a completely different experience of perception of how the story unfolds. And again, that's something I find no analog to in any other kind of storytelling experience.
The other thing that the caller was asking about, or the listener was asking about, was what you need in terms of hardware to play these games, and particularly he had questions about hand controllers. He says they seem to be very critical, and are they?
For the console games we're talking about, you need a PlayStation 3 or an Xbox 360. You need a couple joysticks, and you need a high-def television, and that's about it.
Not real expensive.
No, they're cheaper now than they've ever been, actually. You can get, you know, top flight consoles for, you know, $200, $250, I think. Mm-hmm. Okay. And there are cheap, you know, flat screen TVs you can get. Unfortunately, you really kind of do need a flat screen, because without one, the experience is rather murky.
Yeah. Our guest is Tom Bissell. He teaches fiction writing at Portland State University. He lives in Portland, Oregon, and is the author of the book Extra Lives, Why Video Games Matter, published by Pantheon. I think that people will maybe understand, and maybe this is a source of worry, I suppose, how individuals can be captivated by these games and how they can devote enormous amounts of their life to playing these games. And the word that is often used to describe that is addiction. And I know it's not a word that you don't use that word, and you don't like it because you have concerns about, well, is that really what it is we're talking about? But if I would ask you, well, I know that you've spent a lot of time playing games, and someone might, you know, might look at you and your interest and might want to slap that word on there. If you think there's a better word, what is it?
Joylessly compulsive would be the word I would use.
Joylessly compulsive.
Joylessly compulsive. And there is an element of game playing that can definitely cross over that line. And it's you know, just because of the nature of the medium, it's visceral in a way that's hard to explain. It offers all these weird social interaction possibilities that aren't real social interaction, but it's close enough to social interaction that it sort of feels like real interaction. And there are whole schools of games, like the Warcraft, World of Warcraft-style game, the massively multiplayer online game, as it's called. I don't really play any of those because I just find them sort of kind of terrifying, you know? And I like games that have an end. Mm-hmm. You know, I like games that begin and have an end. And any game that's giving me like a storytelling experience that's throwing back at me something, I really don't have a quarrel with, and I don't generally feel like I wasted my time any more than I feel like I've wasted my time if I've read like a pretty good book or seen an okay movie. And so the games that really involve what gamers call grinding, which is just doing a needlessly or necessarily repetitive action over and over and over again to rack up some kind of in-game reward, that seems to me like a very hard thing to justify to yourself as having spent time doing when you're on your deathbed. I'm going to really, and there are some, you know, I've had some game experiences that have tipped over into the joylessly compulsive. There's no question, but I'm not sure that's the medium's fault, you know? I resist the word addiction just because it feels like compulsive video game playing is usually, in my experience, about something else.
At the same time, though, it seems like for yourself that you haven't quite made up your mind about these games and about the big place in your life they have come to occupy.
No, that's definitely true. I've had lots of thoughts about, you know, about whether I should stop playing for a while or forever or you know, just play occasionally. So I don't really have a good answer to that question. I do know that I read a heck of a lot less than I used to, which is sort of an upsetting thing. But I also feel like, as a fiction writer myself, fiction will always be, you know, gripping and fascinating to me. But it's also a medium whose formal problems we kind of know. I sort of know what fiction can do, 'cause I'm a practitioner of it and a wide consumer of it. And there's just not a whole lot of things that fiction can bring to the table at this point in its developmental process that is really going to be able to blow my doors off. Which isn't to say I'm not going to love books, but just formally, you know, from an interior practitioner's perspective, I'm not really surprised or stunned by anything that I see in fiction anymore. Games every year, one or two games will come up that will do something so formally ingenious that I will be very excited by actually watching this medium work out and establish its own principles, you know, in real time right in front of our eyes. And that's the one thing that keeps me coming back to games, is that, you know, 20 years from now it might all just be a big toy store, and it might have all been just a thing that never lived up to its potential, and maybe they're just always going to be violent and kind of dumb. But I think it's just as likely that the opposite might be true, that maybe some hugely talented people are going to come in and really make some games that everyone is going to just instantly recognize the validity of as, you know, as a creative experience and as a human experience. That's definitely not happened yet, but I think it's certainly, you know, capable of happening at any moment.
We have a caller, and we'll talk with them. Champagne, line one. Hello.
Yeah, hi.
Yeah.
What about the issue of, in terms of, you know, the violence and war games? I know certainly the Army likes, you know, this whole thing in the war games in terms of young kids, getting them interested, you know, in the military. The other one is that certainly the case of, we go back to Marshall McLuhan, the medium is a message. You know, how is this really impacting, you know, you would certainly say, you know, you said, in terms of reading, not as much, you know, that kind of thing. In what other ways are these affecting people? So, two questions there.
Well, the first question, the violence thing, is, you know, really violent games are not intended to be played by kids. And I know that seems like a cop-out answer. It feels like a cop-out answer to me, and I'm the one who just offered it, but, you know, there it is. The really violent games are not and should not be played by kids, and I really don't think that, you know, a kid, so let's say someone under the age of 15 whose moral consciousness is not quite as wholly formed as, say, mine or yours is, I really don't see what possible emotional benefit, like virtual slaughter for hours on end, could do for that kid's development. So I'm kind of a hardliner on the violence in games question, that these systems have very easy-to-use parental controls. If you are a parent, you kind of should really monitor what kind of games they're playing. And if they're playing a lot of violent games, you might consider activating those parental controls and prevent them from doing so. That said, lots of games have done really interesting, affecting things with violence. And you know, one of my examples is, you know, the Iliad, the central poem of Western civilization. It is like 10,000 lines of in praise of martial values, of, you know, deeply militaristic values and hacking people's arms off. You know, it's also, it's much more than that, but the violence itself does not mean it's inadequate. The violence can be, in fact, a crucial part of what the experience is trying to give you. So I'm bored of a lot of game violence, but I also think that a violent game experience can be, you know, a really interesting one, and a really affecting one. As for how games are, training us all to think and be, well, that's a question I've thought about a lot. And I kind of think that, you know, we might all be living 20 years from now in a world that is a lot more gamified than it is now, where you know, we'll always be clicking on screens and touching screens and manipulating things with mouse clicks, and everything will be essentially designed like a game, you know? And I find that possibility of a future sort of terrifying. And there's a part of me that thinks maybe games are fine just as accepted as they are now. You know, that maybe their validity shouldn't go too much further than this, because they have the potential to just creep into every aspect of, you know, modern life in some way. And I do think about the, you know, potential dystopian qualities that a gamified world could have.
Hmm. Well, even now, I think for there are people who are passionate game players who follow this industry, and certainly there is a tremendous amount of stuff written about games and about the industry in reviewing games. There's this huge press that's devoted to that probably most people, if they're not interested in games, don't see, don't know anything about. And I'm sure that maybe a lot of people would be surprised to know that, though, having said all that, that the game industry makes more money than the movie business does. So this is a huge business.
Quite a wide margin.
Yeah. And so already it's an enormous thing, except for a lot of people that's just not part of their daily experience, and it's not something that they pay attention to.
Yes, yeah. And that's kind of the way games are unlike movies. You know, when a big movie comes out, most people who have any cultural awareness sort of generally know. You know, if a new Angelina Jolie movie is out, it's in the ether. But then a game like Modern Warfare 2 comes out, which has the largest opening of any entertainment property in world history, made something like $250 million in a day. And you could go around and ask 100 people, and I bet 70 of them would have no idea that was even happening. Mm-hmm. And that's strange to me. You know, that our popular culture and our, you know, other, our video game culture and our popular culture can have that big of a gulf between them. I just find that startling and weird, and I have no good explanation for it.
On to another caller, Urbana, line number 2. Hello.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
I've actually been really enjoying this conversation quite a bit. I'm about 40, and I've been playing games pretty much my whole life in one form or another. And I just wanted to bring up three things. One's about violence, the other one about technology, and then the last one about writing. The first one with violence, I think it's kind of hilarious. I think there's definitely a track you can go backwards and say that every generation will say that, oh, this is going to bring incredible violence. I mean, go back to the 50s and rock and roll is going to ruin our youth and create violence. And I don't know, maybe at the turn of the century it was roller skates or something. But that I think that violence in video games, I don't think that players or kids look at that as necessarily the same way as we do. For example, there's some kinds of violence where, you know, you're just having to conquer some kind of wave that's coming at you, and it's incidental. It's part of the storyline. It's not really something you absorb. But there are some other kinds, for example, like some of the Grand Theft Auto, which I remember when I was playing through some of that, I was like, well, I don't know. This would definitely depend on what age was playing. Next I wanted to talk about was tech, which I think is hilarious, is that there is so much effort poured into pushing a game to do as much as it can graphically. Like, for example, Crysis. This is a game that the joke of the industry is, wow, you know, you've got a great computer, but can it play Crysis? And then you turn around the other direction, and some of the last few Game of the Years, like World of Goo or Plants vs. Zombies, that these games run on Flash. They're just very, very simple, small games, and they attract so many people. So is technology and pushing a computer as important, which directly leads to some of the storytelling? And I agree. You talked earlier about perhaps that in the future we might have an Oscar award for a video game story or a best leading character, which is, like, imagine a best actor that was completely generated by a computer. You know, I remember that when Lord of the Rings came out and Gollum was such an engrossing character, yet there's no identity you can place, like, a person that played that. Anyway, these were all just observations and thoughts, and feel free to comment on them however. I'd be very interested in your insights on violence, technology, and story writing. Thank you.
Great. Well, thank you.
I think I agree totally with the idea that, you know, depravity is often in the eye of the beholder, and you know, someone who's really interested in games is often going to look at the violence on the screen, which, like, a bystander would look at as just some horrifying maelstrom of flying body parts, whereas the person playing the game might be admiring the physics system or might be admiring, you know, the artificial intelligence of the enemy soldiers. So there are a lot more ways to contemplate video game mayhem than as just sheer depravity. I agree with that wholeheartedly. And I also think that, you know, game violence is just something that happens in this medium that needs to give you obstacles. You know, it's, if a game is about challenge and it's about progression, and you need something to try to stop you. And, you know, games have developed this tradition of throwing things that want to hurt you that are intended to stop you. So I think it's just kind of a formal convention where we're sort of stuck with, like the fact that novels have chapters or something. The second question was the graphics thing, and I really agree with the caller wholeheartedly that some of the games that have really startled me recently, in the last couple of years at least, have not been that graphically compelling at all. And that I really think the techie kind of computer nerd sort of origins of the game industry really begin to show their seams when you get people that focused on making a game look, you know, beautiful. Some great games are really beautiful, and some great games are not. And I think if graphical beauty is something that's an integral part of the game itself, then it really behooves designers to focus on it. But making a game pretty for the sake of being pretty seems to me like a problem that a whole lot of games have dug themselves into to no good end, as far as I can tell.
Let me get to maybe another aspect of this whole business of storytelling and storytelling in games and how that's different. Yeah, it's something I want to come back to, and we're now down to having maybe about 3 or 4 minutes. Because you said earlier that storytelling in games, in video games, is not like storytelling in film or fiction, and that at one point people who were making games were trying to do that. They were trying to tell stories, like, you know, they were trying to be J.R.R. Tolkien, and you can't do that.
Yeah.
They got lost trying to do that. And then you said that game storytelling is weird, that there are ways in which it can be as amazing and wonderful as a novel, say, but it's different. And I guess, yeah, I'm interested in going back to that idea. Well, can you talk about in what way it is different? Are there some unique opportunities for someone who wants to tell stories using this as a medium?
Yeah, well, one of the biggest ways that they're different is that, you know, a film and a novel are linear experiences, mm-hmm, and they're authored. The drama in them is controlled, it's paced. It happens in roughly the same way for every person contemplating this experience, the book or the movie's trying to put them through. It's paced. That's the most important thing. It's the most important word you can use in keeping in mind the differences between video game storytelling. For a certain kind of game, an open world game, say, which gives you the freedom to roam around and uncover the story as you trip storytelling events in your exploration of the world, that pace is gone. There's no such thing as pace because you're essentially controlling the pace. The person who's designed the game can't predict at what point you're going to trip certain storytelling events. And so these storytelling events will never have the same kind of propulsive storytelling logic that would govern a novel or a film. And that's the kind of thing that makes game storytelling feel really inadequate. But I think if you get away from trying to provide the kind of psychological richness of fiction or the kind of plot-based propulsion of film, and if you actually make games more about encounter and chance and loneliness and, you know, strangeness and wandering, then the kind of games I love the most, that storytelling becomes something that is hugely compelling. And these storytelling events, you kind of create them, you know, just by virtue of your being an interactive part of this world. And it's never going to be, like I said, not have the richness of fiction, not have the propulsion of film, but it will have this inimitable game-like consequence and immersion and interaction that those two mediums are not able to approximate at all.
Well, this, I guess, is a way of finishing up. It seems to me that however imperfect it may be, one of the appeals and maybe one of the unique features is here is that in a way that's just not possible with other kinds of storytelling, you become a character in the story.
Yes, you both are the character and you're observing the character.
Oh,
and that's
okay.
That's the cool thing. People mistake the game experience as being one of projection. I'm a big, powerful guy in this world. But at least for me and a lot of the serious game, no, it's not about becoming someone at all. It's about controlling someone. It's about controlling a character that you want to behave in a way that's appropriate to your understanding of their character. And that's like acting in a strange way.
Hmm. And this, it's something that you think is even an experience with, as game design becomes better, it's an experience that will become more and more enhanced, more and more a part of the experience?
I grieve a bit to think of a world in which every storytelling experience is interactive. I wouldn't want to live in that world. In fact, you know, as a fiction writer myself, I don't want the reader to control anything. I want to give them something. So to think that games might push storytelling in general toward like this interactive necessity, that doesn't please me at all. But I do think that for a certain kind of story, that the game interactivity can provide you experience that is really powerful and really, really amazing.
Well, there we'll have to stop. Our guest, Tom Bissell, is the author of the book Extra Lives, Why Video Games Matter. It's published by Pantheon. It's out now. You can find it in the bookstore. Tom teaches fiction writing at Portland State University. He makes his home there in Portland, Oregon. And thanks very much for talking with us today. We appreciate it.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus Archives. Many of our past shows, along with local news features, are available on our website. Anytime that you're ready to listen, just go to will.illinois.edu. At this point, we'll take our usual break for news, and then Focus will continue, so please stay tuned.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from the Sousa Archives and Center for American Music, breathing life into the history of our nation's musical past through exhibits, guided tours, and performances at the University of Illinois. More information is available, and visits can be scheduled at 217-244-9309. Today's programs are made possible by the Courier Cafe, serving breakfast, lunch, and dinner every day. Whether it's almond French toast for breakfast, garden fresh salads and homemade soups for lunch, or burgers and hand-dipped shakes for dinner, the Courier Cafe in downtown Urbana has been offering fresh choices for 30 years.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets, where wheat futures continue to be firm at this hour. They're higher due to ongoing concerns about crop development in Australia and the U.S. plains, but prices are below two-week highs that were hit earlier in the trading session. Dryness a concern in the western wheat-growing area. There are some signs of rainfall for next week, but the showers likely will fall in the eastern crop region. And heavy weekend rain in southeastern Australia is being looked at as unfavorable for mature wheat and is likely to delay the harvest there. Let's go ahead and look at some particulars. In Kansas City, December wheat at 727 and a half, up 6 3/4. March, 742 and a half, up 5 3/4. December wheat at the Chicago Board of Trade at 651 and a half, up 3 1/4. March, 692 and a half, up 5 1/4. May, 719.